The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, Premier League. Watford make Hodgson's choice after West Brom, Fulham and Iceland. Will the Hornets be the latest underdog to benefit from Uncle Roy's magic touch? Pereira out, Lampard in, and more writing on the wall for Everton news. We've got the latest transfer talk ahead of Monday's deadline, and we hear the latest from Cameroon. AFCON, the aftermath of the tragedy there last Sunday, and what awaits this weekend in the Cup of Nations. It's all coming up in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. All right there, listener. Thanks for turning up for this one. It is Totally on Thursday, the 27th of January. And here for you, we have Duncan Alexander. Hi, Duncan.
Hello, James.
Dom Fifield. Hello, Dom.
Hey, James.
And also joining, hello, Dom. And also joining is Maher Mazahi from Cameroon.
Hi, James.
Hi, Maher. It's so nice to, I should say, listener, we all get on a Zoom call together to kind of create the illusion of intimacy, some kind of shared energy and that. And until now, Maher's always been a distant voice from a far-off land on the phone, but today's very much in our faces. And what a pleasant expression that is to be. What? Now he's taking his hat off.
No, but you can see just how, like, I haven't, usually I'm always, like, bald to the skin.
And oh, yeah?
My beard is a little more tame than this, but just okay. When you're in the intensity of, like, a major tournament and it's match after match after match.
Yeah.
And then also hugely significant events. Haven't had the time to even get to a barber in the last, like, 3 weeks. So.
Damn. All right. When you mention hugely significant events, of course, we're coming to you, listener, in the middle of the winter break. Top flight football taking an international pause across Europe, although championship, etc., continuing. There's also World Cup qualifiers in CONMEBOL and CONCACAF. And above all, there's AFCON going on. We've also had managerial news in the Premier League. We'll be getting onto that later on. But we'll begin with events at the Cup of Nations. Maher, it's so good you can join us. Very much a tournament marked by tragedy this week with the deaths of supporters, including two children, as fans tried to get into the game between Cameroon and Comoros. What actually happened now, Maher?
So, I don't know how it is when you go to tournaments in Europe or elsewhere around the world. I've only been to AFCONs, but we usually get to the stadium 5-6 hours early, because especially for this tournament, because you have to COVID test before on site. So that can take a long time if you arrive at the same time as fans. So we got there very early to COVID test, and the one thing we noticed immediately is that there's only two real main entrances that go into this Stade Olembe, which is now the biggest stadium in Central Africa. It holds 60,000 people. They had built it brand new specifically for this AFCON. But leading up into the AFCON, the Confederation of African Football had real concerns about the fact that the exterior fence was not completed in time, and you had people walking all the way around into the south entrance. And in the southern entrance, it led you into maybe, like, I would say 20 tents maximum. And in these tents, they're checking COVID vaccination, negative PCR test, tickets. Once you pass that, you go through a police check, which they open your bag, check your pockets, make sure you don't have a lighter, a water bottle, whatever. And that filters into three gates. So you had 60,000 people going into three gates. And the gate entrance, I would say, is not more than 2 meters in width. The walkway itself is quite large, actually, but even that was constricted. For example, it's like two lanes, but They were forcing people onto one lane for some reason. I think just in case maybe a car had to get out on the other side or something. And when you had a lot of people filtering in, sort of being bottlenecked in, and you have people going through the sanitation testing, and for some reason, this is what the CAF president was talking about yesterday in his emergency press conference, one of those gates, at least one of them, the second gate, was closed. And he was saying all of this could have been avoided if this gate wasn't closed. Who decided to close it? That's where the accountability is going to come from. But that's how it happened. I remember I walked out of the media center into the press box at like 7:20, so 40 minutes before kickoff. And I'm looking at, where is everybody? Like, this is a round of 16 match at the host nation. And, there's maybe 10% full. And sure enough, like 20 minutes later, there was like a steady stream of people coming in. Unfortunately, like you said, 8 dead and I think more than 40 injured now.
All right. Really, really sad, above all because how familiar some of the details sound from experiences of the past. But the tournament continuing, while, as you say, they look to try and work out what happened and apportion blame and that. Was there awareness during the game of what had happened prior to kickoff?
So 10 minutes in, a colleague had sent me just a text message. There was a stampede outside of the stadium. That's not really like... Not stampede, he said there was a rush. And that's not really like the most rare occurrence. You know, it happened in the 2019 final as well. It happened in the 2016 African Women's Cup of Nations here in Cameroon as well. So, like, these things can happen. And sometimes, you know, there's minor injuries or sometimes, you know, people just rush the gate and they get in for free without any tickets. I didn't think much of it. But around the 60th minute, I had another colleague from the BBC. He sort of nudged me and said, hey, there's trouble outside. I thought maybe people were fighting with police, or he's like, come on, follow me. So we ran out at 60th minute of a great game between Cameroon and Comoros, who put up a heroic effort. And that's all been, of course, overshadowed by this, and rightfully so. And as we sort of exited, we went to the area where the crush was, and you could just see, that was just like, it was tragic, because you could see like shoes, you know, like shirts. There were like the horns, you know, like the vuvuzelas. Like I saw a whistle, papers, and just like, just the aftermath of what had happened. But other than that, it was like eerily calm. No, there was nobody else there. The security guards were telling us, yeah, there was a stampede, but it's okay. Nothing else happened. And then I sort of ran back into the stadium, and that's when the rumors of death started to emerge. And almost immediately, the Cameroonian journalists started like getting videos on WhatsApp. They were obviously being forwarded like crazy. And they were showing me, but it's kind of unverified, but you kind of knew it was, this is probably it, you know? And then it's just a matter of, like, you know, as a journalist, when you're reporting on things like this, you sort of have to detach yourself, like, remove any kind of sentiment and just focus on getting accurate, making sure you're accurate, getting, like, the facts and figures of what happened, reporting that, and, yeah, just trying to make sure you're responsible. And then, but there was a moment, just really quickly, the last thing I'm going to say, and then I'll shut up. There was a moment when I, like, after reporting on all of this, I slept at 5 a.m. that night, but probably between 3 and 4 a.m., I just sort of lay down on my couch like this, and I was just like, because I was just so focused on the facts and the figures and what happened exactly at the stadium, and then I just thought about, like, the people. Like, I'm a claustrophobic person. Like, I've been caught in, like, crushes before in anti-government demonstrations, and I remember, like, panicking and hyperventilating and stuff, and I just remember, like, thinking, like, if you're, like, a kid, imagine how scared they must have been, and that part really hit me, so... Tragic, and I was disappointed that we played football the next day. Very, very disappointed. But I think CAF are waiting now for a report, an investigation that's supposed to be on their table by Friday, and then they're going to release one more statement, and we're going to see what we're going to do with that stadium in Olembe.
Okay. In the meantime, the stadium, they moved the games away from that stadium. In a sense, looking at the numbers involved, you mentioned 60,000 fans, the majority of whom trying to get through a gate. It's almost surprising that one thing I feel grateful is that the numbers weren't worse than that, because if you look at similar events in the past, it's almost remarkable that the crush didn't have more of an impact than that.
And part of the gate eventually did like fall over. So, you know, in those situations, that's probably a good thing, because it probably opened up the width a little bit more of the passage. But yeah, I saw a police document of the list of deaths. Which is another jarring thing to see, especially at the end. It just said two unidentified, you know, and the other ones, they had like phone numbers, ages, occupation, everything. So I do think those figures are accurate, but just thankful that it's not more, like you said.
Maher, absolutely shocking there for everyone and devastating for the families of those who died. The tournament, as you say, going on, we'll touch on what's happened on field, what awaits after this. AFCON, we have the quarterfinals awaiting this Saturday. Gambia are the next team to take on host Cameroon after Comoros exit on Sunday. Burkina Faso, meanwhile, up against Tunisia. Whoever wins those two games will face each other in the semis. And the other side of the draw sees Egypt, who put out Ivory Coast, taking on Morocco, and the winner of that will take on either Senegal or Equatorial Guinea. Maher, if it's all right, let's go back to Sunday's game, the one that saw the tragic crush, Cameroon-Comoros, because in football terms, there was some... it was a remarkable story in itself. Comoros, who were playing in their first AFCON, coming in without a recognised keeper, the left-back in goal. They thought that one of the keepers would be able to play, but then was there a change of regulations to mean that he couldn't?
There was a change of regulations the night before or the morning of. We're not 100% clear yet. And this is crazy because Tunisia had benefited from an exemption because players are supposed to test negative 48 mm-hmm. hours before the match, not 24 hours before the match. And if you remember earlier on in the tournament, Kalidou Koulibaly was furious about this because he wanted to be tested the day before the match because he really wanted to play. And they were pretty stringent about that. For some reason, Tunisia, whose federation president is in the CAF medical committee, benefited from an exemption where their player could test negative 24 hours before the match, fly 1,300 kilometers north, play against Nigeria. He came on as a sub, Wadi Khazali, former Sunderland. The Comoros did not benefit from this exemption. Their reserve goalkeeper, Ali Ahmada, former Toulouse goalkeeper, did not end up playing the match. So we ended up having an emergency goalkeeping situation. It's really fun.
All right. He did well, though.
Yeah.
He was brilliant.
Like, honestly, when he came onto the pitch, he was sort of the last one to come on. So I could feel like he knew the spotlight was on him. So, like, stretching his arm like this and having a chat with, I think it was the goalkeeping coach, you know. Every like, 10 minutes, he'd sort of run down to the sideline, talk to the goalkeeping coach. His distribution was okay. For the goal that he conceded, the first goal, I thought his reaction, his positioning was a bit off, but... How bad can you blame him, really? He had a really nice double save where he sort of dove one way and then sort of made a save with his leg in the other. So, and by the way, I spoke to Comorian journalists and they were saying that nobody wanted to play goalkeeper for the match. Everybody was too scared. They didn't know what was going to happen. And he basically stood up and volunteered for this at the stadium. So just like right. 2 hours before the match, that's when they finally figured out who's going to play keeper for them.
I think my favourite bit of his performance was, A, as you say, the double save was genuinely brilliant. But also there was one shot where there's a snapshot of him putting his arms behind his back because he's a defender. So obviously these days you can't. And then he's like, oh, no, hang on. That's just absolutely tremendous. And and we shouldn't forget Comoros has scored one of the great consolation goals of
right.
the time as well.
Changamar's going to take it off! Unbelievable strike!
Don't write us off yet.
It was a magnificent moment. Comoros had been down to 10 men after, I think, 3 minutes? I think very harsh red card. But, a game Sunday that obviously takes on a very different significance in light of everything else that happened around the stadium. Cameroon next up will be taking on Gambia. That's Saturday, 4 o'clock UK time. Again, it's a massive mismatch, Maher.
It's the Gambia. The article "the" is always pronounced before the nation, the Gambia.
All right. Cameroon taking on the Gambia.
Yeah, it is a big mismatch. The Gambia are debutants, but they're really not playing with an inferiority complex. Especially the most impressive players for me have been their front three, Abli Jallo, Moussa Baro, Modu Baro, and even the tall, lanky striker Assane Cisse when he does play. I think they've had really good combination. Moussa Baro has hit the crossbar 2 times on free kicks already. Abli Jallo is one of those players that came through one of the best academies in Africa, Generation Foot. It's the one that Sadio Mane came from. So he went through this Senegal, through Metz in France, which is the usual pipeline. And then from there, he's playing in Belgium for a club owned by Metz. And they have a really good leader in defense too, Omar Colley. I think he's playing in Sampdoria. He just sort of marshals his defense and they're organized. So they should be proud of themselves. They've played well. I just don't fancy them too well against Cameroon.
I didn't realize this, but the Gambia is actually the smallest nation in terms of, is it geography or by population size in mainland Africa?
I'm not sure about that. I think it might be
one of the two
geography
anyway,
because if you look
well, no,
at
I think
it,
it's geography,
like a weird
yeah.
one. Yeah, it's like one of those weird ones where it's really colonial like borders because Senegal is just here in West Africa and the Gambia just follows a river into Senegal. And I think the British controlled that river. And I think that's why we call it the Gambia because it's named after the Gambia River. Okay. That's something that I learned very recently as well. So it's one, it's a weird one. And if you look at it, it's, the river kind of flows up like this, sort of like a smile. And so they call it the Smiling Coast. Yeah. And they're really, really nice people. So it's, yeah, duly named.
Smaller than Yorkshire, I believe, the Gambia.
God, can you imagine if Yorkshire were in an international tournament, we'd never hear the end of it, would we?
In the AFCON.
Indeed. Senegal, in the meantime, have made it through to the quarterfinals. They have also now scored from open play as well, excitingly. They will be taking on Equatorial Guinea on Sunday. Big question here seems to be whether Sadio Mane can feature after he got the opening goal in their round of 16 clash with Cape Verde. He had a clash of heads with the keeper and was subbed off and then taken to hospital.
Yeah, it was obviously coming into this game, Senegal's issue was goal scoring, which is a strange if you've got Sadio Mane, but they scored one goal in the group stage. They still haven't conceded yet in the tournament. Sort of were making fairly heavy work of breaking down Cape Verde, and then there was this awful clash of heads between Mane and the keeper. The keeper was he sent off?
Yeah, he was sent off. Yeah.
Which seemed a little harsh. He was also, you know, completely out of it. Mane stayed on, which caused pretty wide consternation amongst everyone, but then literally scored an absolutely brilliant goal for the edge of the box a few minutes later, and then was substituted off, you know, almost straight away, which I don't think follows concussion protocols, you know. See if they can score a goal, then take him to hospital. But
he lies down on the halfway line, doesn't he, at the restart? And that's when he's substituted. I mean, it's bizarre.
Yeah, it's definitely a bit concerning. But you know, Senegal now in the third tournament in a row, they're in the quarterfinals, and looking pretty good, I'd say.
Yeah, they're taking on Equatorial Guinea, as I say, who made it past Mali, which wasn't the most eventful of games, just two shots on target across 120 minutes. Let me ask you instead then, Maher, about your thoughts on another of the quarterfinals Sunday, which is Egypt against Morocco. Woof!
Proper North African derby, yeah. For me, this is going to be, I think Morocco are the better team, but Egypt have the better player. So who wins that? And that's simply, again, we talked about leaving Hakim Ziyech at home. I thought Morocco were going to struggle with scoring against Malawi. I didn't think that was going to happen, but as the match sort of progressed, Morocco were starting to struggle against Malawi a little bit in the first half. I was trying to keep an eye on seeing, like, who's going to step up here for Morocco? Who's going to make the difference? And it ended up being Achraf Hakimi, the Paris Saint-Germain right back, with a beautiful free kick. I think his second free kick goal in this tournament. He joked after the match that he's going to have to ask Lionel Messi and Neymar to take them at PSG too. So can you rely on Achraf Hakimi to consistently score goals for you? Maybe. I mean, he's that good offensively, but I still don't know if Morocco can score against a really organized, stout defensive side. And that's what Egypt have become. They didn't start the tournament as impressive as they looked yesterday. I thought yesterday they looked very tactically balanced. They had three proper central midfielders in their 4-3-3. The front line played very well. Omar Marmoush, Mohamed Salah, and Mustafa Mohamed. And I think even Carlos Queiroz got his substitutions correct, moving into a 4-2-3-1 later in the match, incorporating more attacking impetus. And I think they took the game to the Ivorians. I think they deserved to win. It ended up being a penalty shootout. But now you have Morocco against Egypt. Yeah, so two really good experienced coaches in Vahid Halilhodžić, shoot yourself in the butt guy, Carlos Queiroz, former Sir Alex Ferguson assistant. And you have these tend to be cagey matches when you have North African derbies. I don't expect there to be a lot of goal-scoring occasions. It's going to be high intensity. But for me, it comes down to Morocco are the better team, Egypt have the better player. Who's going to triumph?
Okay. And the other quarterfinal is Saturday at 7 UK time, and that is Burkina Faso against Tunisia, who put out Nigeria in spectacular fashion in the last 16.
Yeah. Tunisia, I think, set up pretty well against Nigeria. Sometimes tournament play sort of rewards, not negative football, but, like, you know, solid defensive football. I think Tunisia, that was the case against Nigeria. They set up in sort of like a narrow 4-3-3, clogged the middle of the field. And then when the ball was passed out to Nigeria's speedy wingers, Chukwueze and Moses Simon, Tunisia did a good job of sort of dropping down and doubling down on them. So I think they still probably deserve to win the match against Nigeria. I think they look better organized. And it seemed like I hate when, you know, analysts say they wanted it more, because I think, you know, all these players really want to win an African Cup of Nations, but sometimes you can sort of feel like they're more invigorated. I don't know. They're more, you know, they just, it feels like they want it more, even though I'm sure everybody wants it the same amount. So yeah, Tunisia are through. Burkina Faso is an interesting one. I don't know if they're going to be affected by events going on at home. There's been a coup in Burkina Faso. The president and other high-ranking officials have been arrested. But they're one of, for me, they should be the true dark horses of the tournament. Every year we say Mali, look at their central midfield. You know, they have players in the Premier League. They have players here, here, here. But Burkina Faso are the side that consistently makes it to this stage of the tournament, if not a step further. So I think they look good. They're a young team with a lot of willing runners. Marshaled by their coach, who's a former chief of police. And I think that's going to be a very good game, an underrated game.
All right. Chief of police as your coach, that speaks to like a powerful presence on the sideline. And I know you're excited by Youssef Msakni, the tiger.
Yeah, actually, I messed up with that. It's Nims, and I thought it was Nimr. So
okay.
One letter of the alphabet off. So he's not the tiger; he's the mongoose. So I think that's probably a better right. nickname for him.
Classic slip, that.
But
crouching tiger.
You were writing about him because of the brilliant goal he scored for Tunisia against Nigeria. No,
it's his seventh AFCON, and he steps up usually. You know, when on a big occasion, he's done it in CAF Champions Leagues before. And I remember in 2013 him scoring a ridiculous goal against Algeria in a 1-0 victory. And again, he did the same thing here. Just watch the dribble, the body feint, how he sort of sidesteps Wilfred Ndidi, who everybody knows is a really, really good, you know, defensive midfielder. And the shot was a bit lucky. I think the goalkeeper should have got a stronger palm to it. But cometh the moment, cometh the man. He steps up on big, big occasions. So Youssef Msakni is a player that I don't think a lot of people in Europe know, because he's only played in Tunisia and in the Gulf. But here in this part of the world, he's a legend.
Okay, the mongoose. All right. Now, the big occasion for him to step up for Saturday at 7, then as Burkina Faso take on Tunisia. All right, Maher. I mean, hopefully you can enjoy what looked like an exciting set of fixtures, notwithstanding the events of last Sunday. Imagine the mood there, though, is somewhat subdued.
Yeah, I think the investigative report that's supposed to come on Friday and the subsequent, I think people from the Cameroonian FA and from CAF are going to be visiting families. I think all of that's going to bring a little bit of closure and the final decision about what they're going to do in the stadium in Alembe. I don't want to go over there again, but we'll see what's going to happen. But I think slowly but surely people are getting back into the football. Hopefully we can try to enjoy what's left of this tournament. But most important, I think, is that a proper investigation is done and justice is rendered unto the families.
Excellent, Maher. Thank you so much. I hope you do enjoy the weekend, and we'll catch up with you on Monday, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to.
Maher Mazahi, who will be pitch-side reporting. If you're watching AFCON via the BBC's coverage, you can see him at work. Let's see, on the Gambia Cameroon game, and also
the MLS Gambia, no,
yeah, and also Senegal Equatorial Guinea, I think, yes, but only on the BBC's coverage. Nice. All right, next up, back to the Premier League and the return of Roy Hodgson.
Hi again, listeners, it's me. Please don't fast forward. I'm Carl Monaghan from Paddy Power. Watford pulled the ejector seat lever and parted company with Claudio Ranieri in a bid to save their top flight status this week. The Hornets have gone the wise old owl route to get them out of Dodge and have given the reins to one Roy Hodgson. Now, in terms of the Premier League betting, the Paddy Power traders make Watford 3-1 on to go down. To stay up, Watford are a 2-1 shot. To give you context, fellow relegation candidates Newcastle are 8-15 odds on to beat the drop, while Burnley are 6-5. So the odds are literally against Watford, and Roy Hodgson will have to hit the ground running. But he arrives with his favourite personnel right by his side in the form of Ray Lewington, and will be looking to do what in recent times he has done best, beat the drop. We last saw the former Liverpool and England manager when he left Crystal Palace at the end of the 2020-21 season, having ensured top flight survival in each of his four seasons at Selhurst. Wow. Watford have not won since the 20th of November, but they're not completely dead in the water yet. as they still have a game in hand on Newcastle, who sit a point and a position above them in 18th, and two fewer than Norwich, who are 2 points and two positions above them in 17th. Not an impossible job. One would be forgiven for thinking Hodgson might have embraced retirement after such an extensive and weighty body of work, but it seems there's still life for the old dog yet, and Watford fans will be hoping that Roy and Ray can come in and preserve the most important thing to them at the moment, top-flight football, for next season. You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com, or indeed the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s. T's and C's apply. BeGambleAware.org. And remember, take time to think.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
All right, exciting news, listener. You probably saw on Tuesday, following last Friday's defeat at home to lowly Norwich, Watford confirmed that Claudio Ranieri was out, and boom, they'd already sorted out his replacement, Roy Hodgson. Roy, former manager of big clubs and small ones, of nations, of more recently a solid stint at Selhurst Park, 74 years old, taking over a Hornets team now in the bottom three. Crikey. All right, well, Dom Fifield, you've seen him at work at his most recent gig at Palace there. Duncan, you're standing by with some pretty specific predictions about how many points per game Roy will bring the Hornets. Dom, let's come to you first, though. Hodgson, no stranger to rescue missions, West Brom famously, Fulham equally famously, and Palace too, because I forget this, but when he took over at Selhurst Park, it was straight after the Frank de Boer debacle.
Yeah, he took over with them having played for and lost for, no goals scored. And after seven games, Palace had played seven and lost seven and no goals scored. He was brilliant at Palace with everything he did, and he will. I actually look at this and think of all the appointments that Watford have made in recent times, and there have been a lot of them. This is actually one that is really quite sensible, and that surprises me in some ways. There have been slow starts, so I'm not saying this is going to be an instant cure. Although he's got a bit of leeway there. That they're not completely out of it, Watford. I think at Fulham he only won one of his first 10 matches in the league in charge. Ooh. And at Palace it was one win in eight at the beginning, although the team was playing a lot better, scoring goals and picking up points
that doesn't sound promising though.
No, but then after that there was a flurry of results. I mean, Fulham had four wins out of their last five that season and stayed up, and then the following year were qualifying for Europe, and indeed the year after that they were getting to the Europa League final. Palace that year, despite the De Boer experiment, finished 11th. So that's not bad going, really. He will just get them structured. He will have to use this little period. He's only got, I mean, they play next weekend, so he's only got like 10 days of training with these guys to familiarise himself with the squad. But he will lean on people he knows. I mean, Tom Cleverley is in the squad. He gave Cleverley all 13 of his England caps. He was a mainstay of his England side, actually, in the initial period after taking up the reins with the national side. He's got Ben Foster on the books. Again, another player that he knows well. He's got experienced Premier League players like Moussa Sissoko in there. King as well up top. And he will use Ismaïla Sarr when he comes back from AFCON as his Wilfried Zaha character. And it will be structured 4-4-2. It will be more solid, far more solid than it's been. I mean, they've been so porous. I think is it six managers since they last had a Premier League clean sheet?
It's something. Well, is it?
It's absolutely daft. I mean, the stat is ridiculous. And I think that they will get some clean sheets in the period ahead, even with this personnel. It won't be great to watch, maybe, but that doesn't really matter in Watford's predicament, does it?
There's only one team in top flight history that's never kept a clean sheet in a season. That was Stoke at the turn of the century back.
Good to know.
100 years ago. So yeah, I was hoping they'd do it, but you're right, Roy will sort them out.
Interesting to see how he deals, as you mentioned, with some key figures at Vicarage Road, not least Harry the Hornet, who he famously branded disgraceful 3 years ago over that Wilfried Zaha diving.
Yeah, I mean, but he wasn't even, Roy Hodgson wasn't even at the club when Harry the Hornet and Wilfried Zaha had their clash. That was from December 2016 when Sam Allardyce was in charge.
Right.
It was Allardyce's first game.
Was he picking a fight to get the fans on side, do you think?
Well, he was ambushed by it in a press conference ahead of the trip to Watford the following season. In fact, it wasn't even the following season. I think it was actually the start of 2018-19. And he's just... I love that. If you actually see the clip, it's worth having a listen to him. The way he goes, I mean, you're telling me about Harry the Hornet, who I presume is the Watford mascot, as if there's someone else wandering around.
In that way, I think it's disgraceful, you know, because that's not what football matches are about. You know, and certainly if it's provoking the crowd into looking for something which isn't there... It should be stopped.
it's classic Roy, but yeah, he'll have to make his peace with the mascot.
You'd think. You mentioned that extraordinary stat about clean sheets, which blows the one I had out of the water, which is simply that Watford are on their 14th manager in 10 years, which is the most in the last 10 years in the Premier League or the Championship. Crisis club Nottingham Forest, for example, have only managed 12. But Watford, some way off the European leaders in this field, and you will never guess which country they play their football in.
Italia.
It is Italy, and it is Genoa, who are currently on a whopping 19 in 10 years. They're on their third this season, the undisputed champs at this kind of thing.
West Ham have only ever had 18, ever. Which is a contrast.
What, like ever? Ever?
Ever. Ever.
Yeah.
Mm. What, like ever?
Ever.
Ever.
Like even before the Premier League ever?
Spot the man who spent the 90s in Italy. It's like, this is impossible.
That's just not possible.
It is true. East End loyalty, isn't it? I mean, that's what they're all about.
Right. Still, while I digest that, why don't you lay down some pretty exciting stats about what Roy Hodgson will give your club?
Yeah, well, it's a strange thing with Hodgson in that in his Premier League career, he's pretty much done the same job in terms of win percentage and points per game. So Palace, it was 1.22, Fulham 1.28, Blackburn 1.29, Liverpool 1.25, and West Brom a monstrous 1.34. Now, Blackburn and Liverpool, that clearly wasn't good enough. Blackburn had recently been champions, Liverpool are Liverpool. So he's pretty unpopular at those two clubs. But the other three, as Don was saying, came in and saved them all and you know, structured them well. And essentially, if we go for the lowest one of those figures, which is the 1.22 at Palace,
okay.
If he does that for the rest of the season at Watford, and let's not forget they've still got to play Burnley twice and you know, right. They've got some pretty good fixtures, that'll get them to 36 points, which... is kind of the cusp these days of staying up. I think only 9 teams this century have gone down with 36 or more points, and none since Newcastle back in 15-16. Now, you could say that the bottom of the table at the moment is pretty competitive, and given this transfer window, could get more so. So maybe you might need 37 or 38. So I think it will be close, but I think that it's a good decision. I think Watford have got a chance now of scraping out. So
all right. As you say, they travel to Turf Moor a week on Saturday to face Burnley in the next Premier League fixture. Intriguingly, Watford's last 5 Premier League wins away from home have all come under different managers. Can Hodgson make that 6? Can he? All right. A little bit of a cliffhanger there because that game's not for another 10 days. Let's amuse ourselves in the meantime then by hearing next... about Everton and their ongoing search for a new man in charge.
We all enjoy the sport we call the beautiful game.
But since I've retired, I've discovered an ugly, even darker side to the sport we love.
Join me as Jamie Redknapp investigates.
Thanks, Jamie. We'll take it from here. Join Jamie Redknapp for Jamie Investigates, the football mockumentary series. Watch on Paddy Power's Twitter. This week, Jamie investigates Twitter trolls.
Do you know the truth?
Paddy Power.
18+, begambleaware.org.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, smart speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Also on the hunt for a new manager are Everton. And the process is looking every bit as smooth and well-run as you'd expect of this club. Tuesday, the word was the club will be hiring their old flame, Victor Pereira. He of the eclectic CV with titles at Porto and in China and I think Olympiacos, but relegation also in the Bundesliga and getting sacked at Fenerbahce. This failed to charm the fans, who promptly staged protest and daubed the walls of Goodison with Pereira out, Lampard in. Pereira responded with a lengthy interview on Sky Sports News. Where are we now on Thursday morning? Well, let's ask somebody in the know. Greg O'Keefe, Everton correspondent for The Athletic. Greg.
Good morning. It just gets ever more surreal around Goodison Park, doesn't it?
Right. And you know, well, at least there's a fresh coat of paint or two on the place. So is Victor Pereira still the front runner? Is it now Frank Lampard? Could Fabio Cannavaro stage a late comeback? What do you think?
Well, I think the latter of those, I think we can rule out for now. Although I shouldn't be so naive. I think with Everton's owner, you can't really, truly rule anything out. We understood he was supposed to be coming back to London yesterday, you know, as billionaires tend to do. He splits his living arrangements across France, south of France, London, and occasionally he'll dip his toe into Merseyside for the games more than anything. But I think his presence in the UK, at least, might add a little more clarity to the back end of the week and to the process getting a little bit closer to completion, because it is the owner who feels that he wants to have a manager in. He did want to have a manager in by the end of this week. Earliest starter next with the FA Cup tie with Brentford and then the huge game against Newcastle in the Premier League on the horizon. But I think the two unedifying spectacles of first Pereira effectively doing a live job interview on television on Wednesday afternoon.
It means that you cannot look for the negative things, but you must look for everything. You must look how many titles in different countries that I got.
And then, in a more unpleasant still, you know, the supporters vandalising their own, some supporters vandalising their own stadium, such as their anger, just adds to this feeling of chaos around the club. And it's not helpful. You know, Thomas Tuchel spoke about, you know, what unnecessary noise around Chelsea didn't he a couple of weeks back. Well, it feels as if Everton have got like a brass band perpetually parked in the Gladys Street, because this is becoming a sideshow. Well, not becoming a sideshow, it is very much a huge show. It may as well be Ted Lasso set in Merseyside. But it's really not helping this very understrained relationship between the fans and the owner at the moment. There's this strategic review ongoing, which is supposedly going to address how key decisions are made. And we should say that the decision for Pereira to go before, you know, to go on to Sky wasn't the club's. But, you know, he was advised through that, we believe, by people who do mix in the same circles as the owner, and that's just not helpful. It's going right. to lead to people being very frustrated and lead to people thinking that Everton are becoming ever more of a farce.
Right. I had the sense as well that he'd been sat around waiting for some kind of word from the club and decided to just try and nudge things forward, perhaps, by going on TV. Having said that, Wednesday, it seemed like an announcement of Frank Lampard being the club's choice was imminent. Where are we now? What's who would be your tip, do you think, to be in charge?
Well, I mean, again, you speak about, you know, the strange graffiti we've seen. There was that one from much earlier in the week on Cyclism, which said, Pereira out, Lampard in. I think it's the first case of graffiti for a manager who's not even been in, calling for him to be out. Lampard does have more support among the supporters. He has some support on the board as well. Clearly, I think an advantage he has is Premier League experience, albeit ended in the sack, but he could probably talk and did talk in his interview, I understand, about many of the positives that he displayed at Stamford Bridge in terms of, you know, the way the Chelsea young players shone when they were operated under transfer embargo. Everton aren't under transfer embargo, but do have little wriggle room with spending because of their situation with the Premier League profit and sustainability rules, all that money they've wasted without commercial revenue coming in to balance the books. So he does have a chance. I wouldn't say he's the favourite. I'd say Vitor Pereira, I would agree with you. I think that strategically, the decision to do the piece with the cameras was partly a sort of riposte to the criticism he's had on the fan base, and partly a bit of a desperation. You know, he'd slipped from being a favourite to being somebody who the noise was stressed and the owner was getting concerned about the fans' opposition to him. So I think it's very difficult. I would wonder if the board know who their favourite is at the moment. I'd guess they don't.
Okay. It's a situation that started out a little bit comedic, but as far as turning serious, so in that sense, perfectly suits Frank Lampard's modus operandi. Of course, what about the role of Keir Jarabshan in all of this? How much of a concern should that be?
Well, that's really concerning, sort of neutrals and observers, and massively so Everton supporters, who look at Keir Jarabshan's involvement in other clubs. When he becomes very involved, and look, he's a very, very influential and experienced and pervasive intermediary, deal maker and power broker in football, not just in the UK, but across the world. So, you know, he's involved in a lot of clubs. He's involved at Arsenal. You know, he's worked at a number of clubs across the Premier League to get deals done, to get players in and out. But his particular influence at Everton is worrying people. You know, he's friends with the owner. They're both Iranian. They share many mutual acquaintances. The owner seems to trust him as a very intimate advisor on matters with Everton's future, not just transfers. I think he uses him as a sounding board on all things. And that is alarming people who see that Jarabshan isn't a sporting advisor. He is somebody who stands to profit from deals involving football clubs, so they sense that their fear is that there's a mixed interest there, especially when they see players represented by him come into the club who managers don't want. So, for example, Rafa Benitez, we understand, didn't want Anwar El Ghazi on loan from Aston Villa, but yeah, in he came as Luka Dean, one of the better players, went out. So things like that are the sort of the symptom of this ongoing influence of Jarabshan. And I think the owner promised to listen to fans when he sent an open letter to supporters last week. But unfortunately, it seems that when it comes to allowing Jarabshan to call the shots, or seemingly to call the shots with transfers and big decisions at Goodison, or certainly to influence them very, very deeply, it doesn't look like Mashiri is ready to let that one go just yet.
All right. Greg, thank you so much for that update. And you can follow all the latest from Greg on The Athletic. Dom, much like with Roy Hodgson, you've been kind of witness firsthand to Frank Lampard's most recent managerial stint, which ended, I think, was it exactly a year ago today at Chelsea that he got the news?
It was the 25th, so...
Oh, okay, a couple of days ago. All right. But as I say, Wednesday, we very much thought that was going to be the call, and now everything seems to be up in the air again. Maybe, listener, by the time you hear this, it'll all have been settled. But what would your take on Frank Lampard at Everton be?
I think it would be a good job for Frank Lampard to take. I think there would be scope there for him to add to the squad. I think they would find money for him to spend somehow. There may be a bit of wheeling and dealing to be involved. And there's clearly a club with huge heritage and ambition and potential there. It is a mess, but it's also a clean slate. I mean, Rafa Benitez got rid of most of the staff, and then they got rid of Rafa Benitez as well. So, I mean, he could shape it into what he wanted if he's given those tools. Look, there's an element of risk for him. There's an element of risk for Everton if they turn to him. But it's strange because Lampard's a very polarising figure, particularly online. It's
that's unusual. Yeah.
As is this podcast. But it's, I don't know, there are a lot of people there are very, very quick to dismiss everything he's done in management. I think there are positive things that he did. I mean, he took Derby County, a very ageing team, when he took over, who sold Matteo Vidra, sold Andrea Weimann. And he introduced a bit of youth, who, you know, people that he knew, Wilson, Mount, Fikayo Tomori, and took them to a playoff final that season. Okay, didn't go up. At Chelsea, definitely encouraged the development of youth. You know, yes, working in a transfer embargo, but also a transfer embargo in which Chelsea spent £100 million on new players. But he, I mean, look, Mason Mount and Reece James, for example, Tammy Abraham as well, definitely benefited from his coaching. So we can't be completely dismissive and rewrite history. I think that achievement of finishing fourth that year was actually really good in the wake of selling Eden Hazard and not actually, you know, adding to the squad the way that he wanted necessarily. But we sort of remember the unravelling after that 17-match unbeaten run in the second season, and, you know, a six-week period where literally everything went wrong. Mm. But he's definitely got the experience in terms of he knows he's got some Premier League experience to back him up, and he would be a glamorous name and somebody who would attract young players to work at Everton and maybe develop the talent they've got there. But, you know, it's still a risk because he's never really been in a relegation struggle, and that's effectively what Everton are, particularly when you look at Hodgson coming up behind.
Yeah. A risk, though, for him to take that job as well, because it's the kind of club you would expect to stay up, but were they to get into further difficulty, as they're kind of set to do, that would kind of be put at the manager's door, probably. But yes.
I mean, the dream scenario is the Lampard goes to Everton, does really well, establishes them, and Steven Gerrard, meanwhile, goes back to Liverpool. And we've got the site of Merseyside Derby. Can Lampard and Gerrard operate in the same city? It'd be the age-old question. But
one of them would have to play away every week, and the other...
I mean, technically, that is the fixture list, but yeah, so...
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's hope the people who, behind the scenes, write all of this stuff and kind of drip-feed that to the public, let's hope that that's very much their agenda. Excellent. Listener, with that still very much in the balance, let's, next up, conclude today's show with a little bit of transfer talk. Mm-mm.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, in association with Paddy Power. And with Paddy Power, if something doesn't go quite to plan, you can get your money back as a free bet if one leg of your bet builder lets you down. Which will give some cheer to all you Hammers fans when David Moyes signs Marouane Fellaini to help with West Ham's latest injury crisis. Pre-match bet builders only get your stake back as a free bet. Minimum 4 plus legs. Maximum free bet is £10. Other T's and C's apply, and please gamble responsibly.
Totally Football League Show is out on Thursday. No winter break, of course, in the EFL. Championship, League One, League Two. In the Championship, Hull City are also busy changing manager. They've just been taken over. The Turkey-based Akun Media Group, I hope I've said that right, have come in for the previous owners, the Alam family. And after back-to-back wins under the new regime against Blackburn and Bournemouth, the second and third ranked teams in the Championship, they have sacked their manager, Grant McCann. Why? You can find out in the Totally Football League Show. Meantime, transfers. Deadline day is Monday. 11 p.m. on Monday for you to get your deals in, clubs. Arsenal, you won't be having Dusan Vlahovic. Sorry about that. Juventus basically stumped up all that money they had lying around that was earmarked Cristiano's wages and spunk that on the very, 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 very exciting centre-forward from Fiorentina. Are Fiorentina upset about this? Just a little bit. The mayor of the city has said that Juve have trampled and humiliated Fiorentina fans. Italy's former prime minister, himself also a former mayor of Florence, Matteo Renzi, called for a day of mourning. So, yeah. Rocco Commisso, who recently excited some controversy for his comments about the state of football in Italy and calling the Artemio Franchi the biggest piece of shit ever, has, the Gazzetta points out this Thursday, so far cashed in €200 million worth of income from players that he inherited when he bought the club from the Della Valle. They're not very happy with him.
You say that about the ex-prime minister.
Yeah.
I didn't hear David Cameron saying that when Jack Grealish left Aston Villa.
He's a West Ham fan, though.
Well, yeah, maybe he'll do it when Declan Rice leaves. To wait and see.
Perhaps so. Anyway, so Arsenal's search continues. Anthony Martial, he's on his way to Sevilla. He's gone on loan from Man United. That sounds like a really good move for a Sevilla, who you will recall are just behind Real Madrid in La Liga. What, 4 points behind? Let's move on to one that's got Dom excited. Donny van de Beek. Is that on, Dom?
Who knows? Possibly. I mean, they are talking. I'm a bit confused by it, if I'm honest. I mean, I'm not sure it's necessarily a move that Palace needs to do, and it would be quite an expensive loan to pull off in what remains of the window. But I guess if you've got the chance of signing a Dutch international who's clearly a very good player and did brilliantly at Ajax. It's just 4 Premier League starts. It's going to Manchester United.
Right.
It's just very odd. I mean, there are other areas of that Palace team that I thought might have been strengthened ahead.
As someone who's forgotten entirely what Van der Beek does on a football pitch, how would he fit into
about 4 minutes side? Usually.
Yeah.
I think he would. I think in the current team, he would be one of the two attacking number eight, so that'd be Conor Gallagher and Donny van de Beek, which
on
paper is very good. But I still think that midfield hasn't worked of late. It's been quite porous, and I'm not sure Palace are quite at the stage yet where they can have a load of attacking players without having a proper strong defensive midfielder at the back. And at the moment, that's Will Hughes. That's quite a lightweight midfield in my eyes. Conor Gallagher, Will Hughes and Donny van der Beek. But anyway, look, we'll see. It will be an exciting move, and I think it will get people's juices flowing down at Selhurst Park.
Can I ask, Dom, if you're the man to reveal this when it goes through, can you describe yourself as Dommy van der Beek? I think it would... As in breaking news.
Yeah, no, I think we understood, Duncan. Crikey.
I don't really know.
There's a lot of players making way. So there's Van der Beek potentially on his way out. Old Trafford, Martial, we say, heading to Sevilla. Newcastle wanted him, I think. Is that right? They also wanted Jesse Lingard. But in both cases, it seems like Man United have made it difficult for those loan deals to go through, possibly regarding Newcastle as a future competitor for the same kind of targets. I'm not sure.
I just love Newcastle's approach at the moment. This the list every day, there are new people that they've bid for. We've got Mitchell Backer, Dan Burn, Bruno Guimaraes, Jesse Lingard, Diego Carlos, Sven Botman. I mean,
Sven Botman. yes, Bruno Guimaraes appears, it says here, to be on his way to St James's Park for £33 million.
Leon might dispute that.
Oh, really?
I think they issued a statement yesterday saying that no fee has been agreed, but then there's a lot of interest in him and he's obviously a very good player. So
Well, here's Julien Laurens issuing a statement in which he says, "I can't stress enough what a fantastic player he is." Just imagine this, excitable Julien voice. "What a fantastic player he is and what a great coup this is for Newcastle. He will increase the team so much!" So that sounds good. If it goes through, Dom, you're right to cast a little bit of
doubt. He's got the same expected assists as Lionel Messi this season in Ligue 1. So.
Well... Is that a good thing, though, Duncan? The numbers I'm hearing about Messi, more shots than anyone, but only one goal.
Yeah, the goal scoring hasn't worked, but the creativity has been pretty good. So,
all right. Yeah. You posted Messi's goals versus XG on Twitter, I think, on Wednesday, and it was shocking.
Yeah, I've got the numbers since 2010-11, and every season until this season, he's been above his expected goals. With some
How
seasons,
much above?
2012-13, he was 17 goals above his expected goals, which is just...
Put that in perspective. A regular player, how much would they be? Like a Mo Salah, how much would he be above his XG?
Mo Salah would be, sort of 3 or 4 or 5 on a good season, maybe.
Jesus,
I mean, 17
and
is...
he was 17 ahead.
Yeah, and he was over 10 ahead in 5 separate seasons. I mean... It does point to the fact he might be the greatest footballer of all time, but at PSG this season, and you can...
What was he last season at Barcelona, just before we get to the crucial PSG this season?
So yeah, last season at Barcelona, he started slowly, people might remember, but by the end of the season he was still 6.2 above XG.
Sheepers. So how many is he above this year at PSG?
For the first time in recorded history, he's below his XG. He's four below. So one goal. He's got fewer goals than Josh Sargent, which wasn't something I predicted. I mean, people pointed out, as Don said earlier, the internet can be quite a... polarizing place.
No, it can't.
And I had some Messi fans point out that, you know, it's a new system. He's not necessarily the focal point in this, you know, PSG team. But it is, it is, you know, a huge drop-off. So,
Well, if you're curious about the reasons for some of that, we were talking about Messi's underwhelming campaign so far and whether he buys his own bread at the boulangerie. you won't believe what the answer to that is. In last Tuesday's European Totally Football Show. So why not give that a bang if you've got a spare bit of time, listener. All right. Fantastic. One other quick transfer that I wanted to mention. I don't know if Dom and Duncan... in the pod.
CBeebies.
Yeah. So one other one that I wanted to mention. Diego Costa. Diego Costa has just signed up for the 11th club of his remarkable career. Do you know who they are?
Is it Salernitana?
It is Salernitana, bottom of Serie A currently, 8 points from safety. But can he stage a great escape there? Who knows? But excitingly, he'll be teaming up with Frank Ribery down there in Salerno, just south of Naples. What an exciting last third of the season they're set for. My word. Brilliant. Any other transfer news?
Must be how, like, Spanish fans felt when Bolton had like Fernando Hierro and Ivan Camper. They've gone where? All right, well, let's see how they do. All right.
Salernitana, you will recall, were minutes away from being thrown out of the league mid-season because of the fact that they were still owned by the man who also owned another club in the division. But that's all been sorted now. So that's good. Anyway, all right. Well, there you go. Monday we'll be back, and amongst other things, we'll talk about that Canada-USA game that's coming up on Sunday. Absolutely huge match in the CONCACAF, which, no, we haven't only just started to care about because there's no other football this weekend. It is genuinely a big, big game. And loads of other stuff as well. On Monday we'll get the word on the quarterfinals in the AFCON, and much more besides. Listen, do join us for that. Dom, many thanks. You're going to be up on Straight Outta Cobham, probably right now, because in fact you're waiting to go and do that for me to finish this sentence, aren't you?
More Frank Lampard chat, no doubt.
Yeah. All right. And much more besides. And Duncan, you'll be available via the excellent theanalyst.com and on the Soch. Brilliant. Thank you for being with us today. Listener, thank you for joining us. Have a great weekend. And many thanks to producer Charlie, of course. And we will speak to you Monday. Cheerio.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.